All right. Anybody knows anything? My family knows. We listen to a lot of audiobooks. And I used to spend an inordinate amount of time in vehicles. And you can only listen to so much Rush Limbaugh. And you know, Rush is right about a lot of stuff. He's just a man of the world. He's a lost man without salvation, likes rock and roll, sometimes gross sexual things or whatever else. Got some reasonable and good patriotic looks in America, and I like that. But if I'll be honest with you, I'd rather listen to an audiobook. And I've been listening to one on Lexington and Concord, to the great battles of the American Revolution. Go around the country, and you'll find almost every state has a Lexington and a Concord, named for those towns. If you drive here in Allegheny County and you go towards Rochester, you run down the short track, it's called. Short track, T-R-A-C-T. You know where that comes from? When Washington divided out the land to the veterans of the American Revolution, those tracks were shorter there. It was called short track. Still called that, all right? Still got that name from that going on there. But almost every country sooner or later has a rebellion. You know, Mexico has them every so often. Argentina has them every so often. And, you know, Poland or wherever else, they have these rebellions. And everybody says, oh, it's going to be free and it's going to be wonderful. And 10 years later, it's not. And so you ask yourself, what is the difference with the American Revolution? Why did it make a difference? Why was it called the shot heard round the world? What made it to be different? And I'm going to discuss today the difference between two different words that are interchanged today. One of them is patriotism, the other is nationalism. And I see them interchanged, but I'm going to be very picky right now, okay? Nationalism is when a Serb kills a Croat because they have a different flag and they make the sign of the cross different. A Serb makes it with three fingers, a Croat makes it with two, and they'll kill each other for that. That's nationalism. My country's better than yours. Patriotism is a love for the laws and the order of your country. Now, we sing songs like God Bless America, I love their rocks and rills and such. And yeah, that's great. It is. But that isn't why I love America. I don't love America because of its flag, and yet I revere its flag. I don't love America because of its majestic mountains, and I've seen them, I've had my breath taken away by them. I love America because it established a system of laws and constitutional order by which men from all over the world have been able to come and to live and to prosper under its laws. And that's what when I think of the idea of dying for something, I would die for that system. It's worth dying for. In this book I'm listening to on Lexington Concord, it's talking about the year or two leading up to Lexington Concord, and it's talking about Samuel Adams. Today we know him because there's a beer named after him, okay? But Samuel Adams was quite a patriot. He was one of the first to see what they called independency, the idea that maybe we shouldn't be aligned with England. And when General Gage first got into Boston and the abominable acts have been passed and he's got to enforce this, and in many ways, he was a wise man. He understood this was tough to do, so he just tried a very English trick. He's got a bunch of patriot leaders and offered them a lot of money to switch sides. And it says one of the key men was Samuel Adams, A, because he was poor. Number two, he had such influence throughout Massachusetts Bay and through many of the other ones. And when he tried, he was astounded because there was no amount of money that he could offer Samuel Adams. He was offering him an annuity for life from the English crown and for his son's life for the English crown. And it was a large one, but it swayed him not. And the author just makes the point that would have been, had Samuel Adams been lost at that point, it would have been a blow, a terrible one. Dr. Benjamin Church, the great patriot of that time, sold out. He got caught during the siege of Boston. One of his letters got caught, and he was banished from the colony, and then his ship ended up sinking. He died in shame. So the thing is, what was different about those farmers that they stood on a bridge and ended up firing at the soldiers of their own king? And again, it goes on: Vietnam, Cambodia, China, Russia, Mexico, Argentina. All these countries have done that, and it just didn't work. What made it work here? Well, some years ago, I had to go, of all things in the world, to a Zig Ziglar sales conference. If you know anything of Zig Ziglar, he's quite a personality. I was the head of the South Carolina Business Development Club. They'd offered him in. I'd eat breakfast with him and then be at each of the things and such. And I remember a girl asking Zig, you know, does religion have anything to do with your success? He said, no, in the world. Jesus Christ isn't a religion. He's the secret of my success. I like that. That was a good answer, okay? At a business meeting. The important thing was, in the afternoon session, a young man who'd grown up in India was the speaker. He was Zig Ziglar's international representative. And he gave a little bit of his own personal history. He talked about, you know, in India, him and his brother, the traditional walk 10 miles to a school and study. And his parents telling him, yes, we live in poverty, but if you study hard enough, you'll be able to get into an American university. And him and his brother, they did. Boy, they made it. They got into an American university. And he said one of the puzzles for him and his brother, because they were studying history, this is when they were still in India, and there was a list compiled of the top 100 political thinkers of all time. Plato, Aristotle, you know, all time. And him and his brother were puzzled, how did 30 people from one tiny nation of 3 million people get on that list? He said, we have cities in India with 10 million people. We don't have one person on that list. How did one nation with 3 million people get 30 men on that list? So him and his brother speculated. You know, there they are in India. They don't have a lot of resources, but they speculated. And they said, well, it must be their education system. When they got to the United States, they found out that Washington only had a few years of education. The Carrolls went to Catholic school. John Adams went to a public school. Patrick Henry was homeschooled. So the question is, what happened? How did these 30 men become the top political thinkers, or 100 of the top political thinkers of all time? And he said him and his brother finally figured it out. It was they all learned to read and think out of a King James Bible. Now this is a guy from India, okay? Trying to find what is the common root amongst these men that they learned to think so well. Now, what is it that you could learn in the King James Bible that would make you think so well? And I want to look at some of those things today. I want to show you what a colonist would have known in those days. If you know anything of American history, you know that there are two books that almost every single cabin, no matter how lonely, how far back in the woods it was, that they had a King James Bible, and they had a copy of the Pilgrim's Progress. Those two books were probably all they had. Now, some of you know Tom Tascone. He was here briefly at Youth Week, just a little bit or whatever. His daughter Jessica has never tested over a 60 IQ. Lovely girl, loved by her parents, it's dear, okay? But the thing is, she's never tested above that. Well, I was in their home some months back, and I saw on the couch a biography of James Madison sitting there. Well, I love to read biographies of presidents and such. And I looked at it, and I could see it wasn't a little child's, but it was more like on a high school level. It didn't have big words or anything, you know, in the sense of large print. But it was written on a high school level, and I asked Tom, I said, well, who's reading that? Oh, Jessica is. Jessica. And her mother said this, well, she likes to read these dumb romance novels, so after every three, I make her read a biography. And I said to Tom,
I said, I thought she was mentally retarded. Oh, we taught her to read out of a King James Bible. She can read anything. Okay? Now, imagine having a continent with 3 million people on it, and they've all been learned to read and write out of a King James Bible. How would they think? I want to show you some things.
Turn with me, if you would, to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis chapter 10. Look at verse 5. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after his families, in their nations. Those are the three ways that God originally divided the world. Now, if you know anything, number one, when the tongues were divided, it wasn't for man's good. It was to hinder man. It's to stop scientific progress. God said, if they all speak one language, there's nothing they can't do. Nothing. Time travel, he said, there's nothing they can't do. Reach the stars, there's nothing they can't do. Right? What's happened since the world's begun all speaking English? Think of the scientific progress that's gone on. Just since such time as the whole scientific community speaks to each other in English. That's beyond anything we can imagine. That proof of what happened there in Genesis. But he also divided people in families and in nations. Now, families were given for your benefit. It says in the Word of God, behold, he putteth the solitary in families. It's one of the kindest things that he can do. If you've ever met somebody who doesn't have a family, it's a tragic, it's an awful thing for that person when they don't have a family. I've told you that thing before. My friend Arnold has two parents. Both of them concentration camp survivors. Both of them showing up on the docks of New York in the 1950s after all these turmoils and everything. And neither one has anybody left that they know of. As it turned out, one of them found with their brothers and sisters and such. But at that time, they had no one. You know what they found out? They were both from the same tiny little area of Czechoslovakia. It'd be like if you're somewhere maybe 30 years from now, 40 years from now, everything destroyed that you ever knew, and you're living somewhere, maybe in Australia, and you meet somebody from Angelica. You know, it's wild. They're in this Allegheny County, right? And you're amazed at that. You know, they got married. Not really knew each other, just got married. And but that's God again, his mercy, taking the solitary, putting them in families. It's one of the kindest things God can do. But if you know anything of families, after a while they get big. I'm not talking about just one man and woman having children or like rabbits or whatever else. But one of the things Ruth Ann and I laugh about, John Mark was born 25 years ago today, and really one of her most miserable pregnancies. And the second he popped out, she goes, I want to have another one. Everybody's looking at what? I mean, he was sitting there, slimy little kid. I don't have another one, she said. You know, and you know, you don't know whether to love her or beat her, you know. She says those things. But regardless, you end up having two more after that. But regardless of that, families grow exponentially because brothers and sisters go out there and they take wives and such. And after a while, you know, family reunions become big things. There's a lot of people there, and some go to great lengths trying to hold it all together and such. When my father was very small, his grandmother regularly got invitations to the Grant family reunion, President Grant's. He wasn't sure exactly how, but she would receive those invitations in the mail. They would want her to go somehow. She was a cousin or something. So a rich family would, you know, would go to great lengths trying to hold it all together or whatever. But God sees each of these families. He sees them. And what he did is the next up order was nations. If you go back and study the word nation in the book of Genesis, doesn't mean like we do today when we think of the United Nations. A nation was a group, a family that had grown big enough to do self-government. The word nation in a King James Bible is equivalent to our word ethnic. Okay? All the Poles, the Germans, the English, the Scots. And they saw them as nations in that sense. How were they ruled? Well, under English common law, there's a word called primogeniture. Well, that is, it's Latin for the firstborn. Primo, first, geniture, born, okay, generation. And so the firstborn would rule, unless for some reason he lost that right to be the firstborn. In the house of Dale Morey, Luke would be the ruler, all right, primogeniture. If Dale had had 20 more sons, Luke would still be the one ruling. Then Luke's firstborn would be the ruler. He would be called a king, okay? That's what he would be called. He'd be called a king. Many times when you see when Israel would go into the land, they might be fighting one nation, but there'd be many kings. In other words, those nations might subdivide. But what it was, it's how big an area can one man rule and hold a family together where they're all saying Uncle so-and-so's son is the one that ought to rule. And he'll be in charge over us. What did God think of that system? God endorsed that system. He said, where the word of a king is, there is power. Okay? Kings were something God honored. God blessed that whole idea. Why? Because it was a family rule. Okay? Family rule. I want to say this. Oftentimes you'll hear people talk about the idea that how Israel was not allowed to ever marry into another nation. Okay? Keep in mind, nation didn't deal with color. Nation dealt with the specific ethnic group you came out of. If we applied that today, a Scotchman couldn't marry an Italian. Okay? A German couldn't marry an Englishman. Okay? If we applied that rule today. You have people, especially down south, who only make that rule about blacks and whites. Alright? And then they try to apply it. It has nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with color. If we're under today, God would strike all American dead. I mean, you don't find anybody purebred anything other than purebred mongrel. Alright? Most of what we are. And such. But the thing is, God's blessed us in that sense. That's one of the things we're going to look at. How did it go from there to the system we have today? But every single person that would have grown up in those colonies saw George III as his sovereign, as his king. One of the things people don't realize historically, that when it did finally start, and the war started, do you realize that until Thomas Paine published Common Sense, the only way they could get those colonists to fight is they told them they were fighting for the king. That Parliament had enslaved the king, and Parliament's passing this law, Europe holding the king's rights. And they actually had to propagandize them and make them think that, because they weren't going to take shots at their king's soldiers. When they saw them as Parliament soldiers, they'd take shots at them. Thomas Paine straightened them out and said, look, the king's behind the whole deal, all right? And that's the people kind of woke up to that. So the thing is this. If you were on a desert island today, let's say that you were on a desert island and, you know, you planted a few crops and such on it, you've been cast away on this island, and pretty soon a log shows up and there's another person on that island and he crawls up there and you realize, you know, this island's big enough for the two of us to share. And you divide that island and such, and you ask yourself, well, what are your natural rights? Okay? You have the right to go steal from him. No, the Bible says thou shalt not steal. You can't do that. Can you go kill him? No. But you have the right of preservation. Okay? You have the right, you know, if he comes after you, you get to kill him or whatever. And so the American colonists took great delight because of what was called the Revolution of 1688, the Glorious Revolution, or the Bloodless Revolution, which had been, it took place in England in 1688 when William and Mary came to the throne. And in that revolution, the lower house of Parliament became masters over the House of Lords. They made a rule that no economic law could be passed unless it started with the lower house of Parliament. The House of Lords couldn't start a tax bill. We still have that in our Constitution. The House of Representatives has to start every tax bill. It can't initiate in the Senate. Okay? It's one of our rules there. We picked it up from. So when these colonists talked about their rights as an Englishman, those rights were secured, Magna Carta, many court rulings in between, the Glorious Revolution, and when they came to the several colonies, every one of them expected that those rights as an Englishman would be retained. Now, I've talked about this before, but just to give you an idea how English rights came about and such, under Magna Carta, John promised that he would never attack a castle unless he put his flag up declaring war. It would never be a sneak attack. And that he would not enter a castle without the permission of the lord of that castle. Part of the Magna Carta. Well, what was a castle? Well, not this thing you see in Disneyland. A castle meant that you owned your property in your own right. Now, back in the time of Magna Carta, who owned the property in their own right? Only the great landed lords. They were landlords. So they would have a central house that's called a castle. But under English law, a castle isn't a building. A castle is a legal principle that you own your property in your own right. So in the 1600s, the sheriff went into a man's cottage to drag him out and arrest him, and the man took his blunderbuss and explained to the sheriff by blowing him away that that was a mistake. And so it was an open and shut case in English law. You killed the sheriff, okay? Eric Clapton could have been singing, "I shot the sheriff," all right, or whatever. But the thing is, he shot the sheriff. And they dragged the man into court, but his lawyer argued this, "Your Honor, that man owned his cottage. Therefore, it's a castle. The sheriff came representing the king. He didn't have a right to enter." You know what the judge ruled? "Though a man's home be but a cottage, even the king may not enter without permission." Okay? That's where we get search warrants from. If a cop wants to come into your home, he either gets your permission or he goes to the judge and he gets a literal declaration of war. You don't let him in, he's going to come in blazing, all right? And we have that to this day. So many of our rights came from those things, and the American colonists understood those things because they are people who fled England not just for religious liberty, but oftentimes when there would be a repression against the liberties that were building and great waves of them would come here, and they would establish those things. Now, I want you to go with me to Genesis 17. If there's any group of people on earth who should understand the basics of American freedom, it should be Baptists. They should understand. One of the fascinating facts about the American Revolution, if you take every denomination, Catholic, Presbyterian, Jews, Unitarians, Methodists, and you take them, and ask, well, who was loyal to the English king? About one third. Who stayed neutral? About one third. Who was on the American side? About one third. Every denomination divides that way except Baptists. Baptists were almost to a man all on the American side. Why? Because they understood this Bible like few other people did. Okay? They understood. One of the ironies to that is the colonies were in the habit of taking Baptist land away from them because they wouldn't pay the church tax. And King George III had overruled that, like a Supreme Court ruling, and made them give it back. So there they are, even their own interests or their own homes and lands were at stake. And yet they still sided with the American Revolution. Why? Because of principles in this book. Now, Genesis chapter 17, verse 6, God talks to Abraham and says, "I will make thee exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations thee, and kings shall come out of thee." Okay? And again, kings is when a group of a family got big enough that they needed their own rule, maybe the land they're living on or whatever else. Again, that right of primogeniture, whoever the oldest of the firstborn or the firstborn of the firstborn, he is that king. And God absolutely kept that. God loved that. God established that. Where the word of a king is, there is power. You're told, don't mess with the king. What would make these people fire against the king's soldiers? Well, go with me, if you would, to Genesis 4. Look at verse 6. "And the Lord said unto Cain, Why art thou wroth? And why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted. And if thou doest not well, sin lieth in the door, and unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him." What do you mean his desire?
In other words, it was natural
in those days for a man to want to follow the older brother's lead. It was natural,
his desire. But he said, only if you do well.
If you do well.
And it's a principle of what's called tyranny. Now, tyranny was established under English common law in a marriage situation. What do I mean by that? Well, you've heard of the rule of thumb. The rule of thumb was that a man could beat his wife, but never with a rod bigger around than his own thumb. That was the rule of thumb. That's where that came from. It was understood that a man might be a fool, that a man might make bad decisions, that calamity might happen to him. His wife was expected to be in obedience to him, and her property was his property. But an English judge could break that bond on one condition.
If it could be proven in a court of law that when that man made decisions,
he cared nothing for his wife, and he cared nothing for his children. That every decision he made was just for him. Only me. That's it. Remember when I told you that? That I back your divorce because that man absolutely cared for nothing but himself. Nothing. That's just old English law. He cared for nothing but himself. Every decision he made was for him. Never considered his wife. Never considered his children. The English law courts would have called that tyranny. And they would have said at that point, he has voided his right. He is not doing well. Her desire does not need to be under this man. Okay? He voided it. Part of the whole issue that went on in the Second Great Awakening through New York was that idea, what rights does a woman have when her husband's an utter alcoholic? And, you know, and he's beating her and such. It's where the women's rights movement came from. And if you read behind it, it was a just and a good thing. Okay, I understand it's gotten out of hand in many ways today, but it was a just and a good thing when it came out. It was something that principled people would believe in and say, yes, this is right. But it comes out of that idea, the natural desire of who you want to rule over you is voided when the person doesn't do the right thing. I don't know how many of you ever read the Declaration of Independence, but Thomas Jefferson takes a long time explaining to them why this man, George III, is not a fit man to rule over a free people. He has hired the Indians and their savagery against us. He has passed laws to do this. He has passed laws to do that. And he went through and he detailed to God-fearing, Bible-believing people why George III should no longer be their sovereign. Now let me ask you this. If you were suddenly in that condition, all your life, all your dad's life, all your grandpa's life, as far back as you can remember, your desire has always been that King of England. And you would fight for it, you'd die for that, you'd teach your children, you'd beat them if they did otherwise. Yeah. If you suddenly believe that that bond is now broken, it's over, then who has the right to rule you? It went right back to you as the head of your own family. It's back to you. You have it. It's the king of, it's not communal property anymore. It goes back to all the original owners. Every head of his own family now became his own ruler. And that's why the Constitution of the United States says we the people of the United States. It's not we the states. It was one of the differences in the Confederate Constitution. They tried to make all power come from the states. Abraham Lincoln mocked them over it. Okay? Mocked them. They never understood where power came from. Each man then lent his power to a central government in the state that he's in. He lent that power to him. He gave it to him. Now, does a man have the power to steal? No. Therefore, does the government have it? No. Because it got all of its powers and its authority from the people. Therefore, it can't have any power that people wouldn't have in their own right. And by a man in his own family. If we took the Ireland's and put them off somewhere on a mountain somewhere, left them by themselves and said, well, what rights do they have? A nation can have no more rights than what they have there. No government can have more rights. It cannot. Because its power comes from the people, government of the people, by the people, for the people. It cannot have any more rights than an individual in its own capacity would have. And that's what made those farmers different. Why would major parents disperse? They just stood. There in the Lexington Green, somebody just fell. Just fell, just dead. And on they marched again and such, and finally met the farmers at the bridge.
But what was the difference? Every single man there understood his rights under God, what his responsibilities were, what his duties were. He understood that. And he understood that now, because I no longer had this king, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is where I have deposited this. That's why taxation without representation was tyranny. Why? Can I just walk up and, hey, Stephen, I've decided to improve the road. Give me some money.
No, I can't. That's tough. Okay? Therefore, all taxation has to be by agreement. We agree together. Here's what the rate will be. So we elect representatives. Taxation without representation is tyranny. But if you have a representative, you had a say in how this tax was done. That's so important to understand. Now,
let's see. Go to Genesis chapter 49. I'm going to show you something, and we're going to backtrack just a little bit about kings here, but I want you to understand something with Israel. You're going to be under a king again one day. King of kings, Lord of lords. You know, just to give you an idea, Henry VIII was a terrible man in many ways, but he made three decrees that absolutely changed the English-speaking world forever, and in many ways molded the new world more than anyone else of those three decrees. Number one, he was afraid because his son Edward was a sickly young man. And he didn't think that Edward would last long enough to even have children. So Henry made a decree that should Edward die without issue, that Mary Tudor, Henry's oldest daughter, would rule as a king. And you know what? All of his counselors are terrified. Yes, sir, we'll do that. But he also knows that upon his death, his writ is dead. In other words, any law he makes is dead. So he then ruled that if Mary Tudor were to die without issue, then Elizabeth should reign as a king. Oh, they all looked at it and said, yes, we knew there was only one way to make that happen, and he went to the Parliament. And he told the Parliament, you will pass a law. And they passed a law that Edward would be the king. If Edward died without issue, which he did, Mary Tudor would become king. And if she died without issue, then Elizabeth would become king. You realize since that time, no English-speaking people has ever had a sovereign over them that an elected representative body did not appoint. Never again. It's never happened where an English-speaking people have ever, ever had a sovereign over them. But not a popular elected body or election brought them up. Henry would have died to know that happened. He'd have died, he'd have writhed. He'd be writhing in his tomb if he understood that now. Number two, Henry divorced Catherine of Aragon. The divorce proceeding was a shambles. It was a puppet court. It was unjust in many ways. And the problem is that all court proceedings in England could be appealed to the Vatican because England was a kingdom. Spain was an empire. And it's not just words. Under Roman Catholic law, an empire, the king or the emperor could stop a court proceeding from being appealed to the Vatican. Under a kingdom, a king had no such power. So only the Spanish king could so fix his courts that the Pope couldn't overturn it. What did Henry declare himself an emperor? And the British Empire. And since that time, no English-speaking people has ever had a court case taken outside of their land and adjudicated outside of them. Number two, one of the great things. The number three thing Henry VIII did is he decreed that the universities had the right to print the Bible. That's what saved the King James Bible. Had it been left with the King's Prayer, he made a mess out of it. It was Cambridge and Oxford that went through over the years, the last 300 years, and kept that Bible preserved and worked on it so much.
kept it like it is, and constantly purging of it, printer's errors and such. So again, we sit here and think we don't need a king, and yet so many of our freedoms today came by the word of a king. And we don't even understand that. Now I want to show you a couple of things about kings here. Genesis 49, if you look at verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Now, we understand this, that David is the one who's finally anointed the king, and there's a promise that out of his loins, that kingdom will always come. That's where that crown was. So, one type of king, one type of rule, is where one family keeps that rule. By the way, did you ever read the book of Genesis where it talks about the dukes of Esau, and duke this and duke that? Why does it say it? Because God believes in rule. Okay? Why are they dukes? Because each one is, in other words, stop and think of this. Let's say that I made Sam the king in our house. All his brothers would be dukes because they're of the same generation and they have this royal pattern to them, but they never ascended to be the king. Okay, dukes. And so God looked at that royal and God honored that. And he called all of Esau's sons, the ones that weren't kings, he called them dukes, men of great nobility. And he saw it as such. And people were to honor them as such. David had that in his own home. But I want to show you something else. Go to verse 26 in Genesis 49. He's talking about Joseph. The blessings of thy father have prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors under the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him that was separate from his brethren. Here's the difference between the two kingdoms of Israel. One of them, the blessing is on the family itself. The other one, the blessing is on the crown, the northern kingdom. And God can take that crown off of one man and just walk over and stick it on another one. Why? Because the blessing's not on the family. It's on the crown. Okay? It's on the crown itself. The southern kingdom, the blessing's on David's family. It's got to run through David's family. But, again, we're doing this as a crash, hurried course. But I want you to understand this idea that your colonial ancestors understood where power came from, how God distributed it, how God distributed government, how he did that. I remember in the early days here in the church. And I had so many people coming here who really, one foot in the welfare office and the other foot here. And, those of you who remember Melissa and Debbie would be here and Tanya and Dale and Amy and such. And, you know, they're coming to church now and begin to change their lives a little bit. And there was an election going on. They came out and said, well, how should we vote? And I said, well, I'm not telling you how to vote. It's the last thing I'm going to do. But I'll teach you some principles. Teach you some principles. And I explained to them how the Constitution of the United States had grown out of the Declaration of Independence. And how the men that wrote those things believed in the Bible. And they believed that you could not break the laws of Moses. And that all laws had to conform to that. And I said there's a great division in our land today. Whether or not laws should just be arbitrary and how you feel. Or should law be based on precedent and the laws as they were written down. And I said, here's how I believe. And I said, you go find a candidate that believes that law should come from the Word of God itself, from actual principles. Okay. Number two, I taught them about Israel. How God said he blessed them and blessed thee and hate them and curse them and curse thee. And I just said, you need to find a candidate who will follow that. And number three, I taught about the sanctity of human life, that baby in the womb. How that baby is alive and how God hates those who can't see that baby's alive and such. And I said, you need to find candidates. I said, after that, vote however you want. Okay? But you need to find those things. Teach people principles. Don't tell them what lever to pull. Teach them principles. People come up to me some, are you a conservative or are you a liberal? I'll tell them what I believe. Oh, but are you a conservative or a liberal? No, they don't know what any of that means. They don't have the least idea what it is. And it's amongst the conservatives, amongst the liberals, and, you know, right now, amongst the common people in America and such, Trump's a great deal. But I'm telling you, when the economy goes south in 6 years, he won't be a great deal to them anymore. He won't.
And I should have said President Trump. He jumped me today on that. I always insist that my people use, you know, Senator Hillary Clinton, President Barack Obama, President Donald Trump, and then I'm the worst violator. But you know what? If you're conservative, you'll show honor to whom honor is due. All right. Now, the last place I want you to take you is Revelation 10. And look at verse 11. Now keep in mind, in the book of Genesis, God divided the world by tongues, kingdoms, and families. In the book of Revelation, he adds a new category. And he said unto me, verse 11, thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kingdoms. We go to the book of Revelation, we can understand, I mean the book of Genesis, we can understand what nations and families are. What peoples? Well, what would happen if the English people put off their king and living in their borders are Germans, Scotchmen, Irishmen, Africans, Englishmen, Frenchmen, Spaniards, and they want to come together and become a unit in the world and to form a common government, and they can't biblically call themselves a nation because they're all these different ethnicities. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, they call themselves a people. Why? Because you can't call yourself a nation. People ask me sometimes, is the United States in the book of Revelation? You just read it right there. Revelation 10, verse 11. He saw a different type of thing that didn't exist in the book of Genesis. When Jesus Christ came back. Peoples. Right? Peoples. Why? Because we established something new that had never been before. A different type of government on this earth. Where each man in his own right had his own individual rights, duties, responsibilities, and he understood which of those that he lent to the government, those that he kept to himself. And just to make sure, people wrote them down in the Bill of Rights. They wrote them down to be understood. Do you realize that Noah Webster was against ever making a Bill of Rights? You know why? He said, we might as well put in a Bill of Rights that a man can lay on his left side of his bed for so long and then his right side for so long. Those are such a natural right to man. If we ever come to the point that people need them written down, we've probably lost it anyway. Those things in the Bill of Rights, if we ever come to a point, the average school kid doesn't understand it. The average man doesn't understand those rights are his by nature under God. We're probably lost in it anyway. Okay? I understand we're in the tail end of a great nation. Okay? But I also understand that every single person that comes to this church or any like-minded church can know their own rights. We're not going to march on Washington and change it. Jerry Falwell and all them trying, it's not going to work. Okay? We're not going to march to Albany or Harrisburg and change it. You can change your home. You can train your children to know what their rights are, who they are. You can train them on that. And they can understand who they are before God, their responsibility before God. And if it ever comes to the point that people are being rounded up in concentration camps and they go, they still have the truth. Okay? Not just be some of those admired out there and not knowing and nameless people and going off to their death. They can go and die as patriots. Not nationalists. People just proud of America because of our flag. I'll stand for my flag as long as it stands for constitutional order. As long as it stands for the rights of man as they are. Our duties before God. Our duties to our country. As long as it stands, I'll stand for that flag. But I'm not dying for that flag just for the flag's sake. Not dying for America, just for America's sake. I'm dying for a constitutional order that God loves and that God made. Pastor Haynes,